The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. You may be seated. The first case on our calendar is the State of Paul Norton versus Motors Mutual Insurance Company. Mr. Fitzgerald.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this honorable court, I'm here on behalf of Motors Mutual Insurance Company this morning to urge the court to reverse the 8th District Court of Appeals decision and reinstate the summary judgment decision of the trial court, finding that there is no uninsured motorist coverage owed in this case. Mr. Chief Justice, may I please reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal?
Your time there.
Thank you. The issue before the court this morning involves an unprecedented expansion of uninsured motorist coverage. 35 years ago, this court, in the case of Abate versus Pioneer Mutual Casualty Company, recognized, and it's been reiterated by this court on several occasions, that the General Assembly's enactment of the uninsured motorist statute was designed to protect persons injured in automobile accidents. There was no automobile accident in this case.
Counsel, you have a elaborate three-prong test that you urge us to adopt.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm always worried about rules like that because it's hard to conjure up all of the things that might, all of the fact patterns and occurrences were we to adopt the rule that you suggest that someone might try to fit into. I mean, here, your argument as to why it should not apply is fairly easy to understand and straightforward. I'm wondering, is the three-pronged test or rule really necessary for you to prevail?
Actually, it's not, Your Honor. The rule that prevails in this court or in this state currently is set forth in the case of Kish versus Central National. In that case, the court set forth what can be characterized as an intervening event test. The problem with implementation of just the intervening event test is that it in essence skips over the first question that needs to be addressed, and that is whether in fact there is a causal link between the uninsured vehicle and the insured's injuries. You don't get to an intervening causation analysis or an intervening event inquiry until you've established that there is causation. Now, so the proposal in the three-part test here requires that the first prong looks at whether or not there is a causal link, whether or not the uninsured vehicle was a contributing factor to bring about the accident and the insured's injuries. I don't think it's...
For example, the driver of the vehicle has a medical problem that would, it wasn't the vehicle. In other words, it just seems to me if we take this three-part test, then insurance companies and skilled defense lawyers for insurance companies are going to want to drive a freight train through there in terms of all kinds of other examples where your fact pattern's pretty straightforward and it might not require all that you ask us to swallow in order to get the relief that you asked for.
Well, I think that in this case, the intervening event test, motorists would still prevail, even though the Court of Appeals felt that it did not. In this case, there is no question that the injury-causing event resulted from the accidental dropping of the syringe and needle that had nothing to do with the operation or use of this ambulance. It's merely the site of where the injury happened. It's just Judge Cooney recognized in her dissenting opinion This event could have happened anywhere. It could have happened at Mr. Nord's house while the paramedics were attempting to administer aid in his home. It could have happened while they were extricating him from the ambulance. It could have happened in the emergency room. It has absolutely nothing to do with the operation or use of this ambulance in this case. So, Justice Pfeiffer, you are correct. We do not need to have a three-pronged test to prevail. However, I don't think that the three-pronged test is anything different than the harmonizing of what this court has already said on at least three different occasions. And in each of those three occasions, the court did not address the causal link initially, because in each of those cases, there was, in fact, an automobile accident that had preceded the injury-causing event. Now, each of those cases were intentional misconduct, a shooting, an abduction, and a rape. But this court has recognized that the mental state of the tortfeasor, whether it's an intentional tort, criminal conduct, or negligence, is not what is determinative of this issue. It is focused upon what is the instrumentality that causes the injury. In this case, it was strictly the syringe and the needle. It had nothing to do with the ambulance. It's undisputed.
Counsel, then the provision in the insurance policy, which states that it arises from the ownership, maintenance, or use of the vehicle, what would your response be to that clause within the policy or that delineation within the policy? This accident occurred while the vehicle was in use. What's your best argument to counter the appellee's position on that?
Well, the question still needs to be answered whether or not the use of the vehicle played any role, any contributing factor in bringing about the injury. The mere fact that it was the site of the injury should not be determinative of whether or not it was covered by that language in the policy.
But the policy language is in use, ownership, maintenance, or use of the vehicle. There's no qualifying or delineating language that would take that out, take what happened inside of that vehicle and not put it in the context of the use of the vehicle.
Well, the test that this court would still apply under the Kish analysis would still require that.
And that's the intervening activity by the tortfeasor.
That is correct. Regardless of whether or not the incident happens within the vehicle, outside of the vehicle, if the vehicle is an instrumentality that brings about the injury and there is no intervening event in between there, then there will be no UM coverage.
This was a summary judgment, and so it appears that there could be a question of fact as to whether that vehicle caused the paramedic to drop that syringe. And I think that that's what the Court of Appeals concluded, that could have been the cause of it. So it would be the use of the vehicle.
Well, that would only be possible if there was speculation, Justice Resnick. In this case, the undisputed facts from the paramedic, both who was operating the vehicle as well as the paramedic who accidentally dropped the syringe, it was undisputed. Both of them testified that the operation of the vehicle in no way contributed to cause that syringe to slip out of the paramedic's hand. There were no sudden turns, maneuvers. There was no vehicle that cut off this ambulance, causing the ambulance to have to suddenly stop. Nothing happened in this case. I recognize that there may be another fact scenario where the operation of the vehicle, a sudden movement or turn, may have caused this paramedic to drop the syringe, but not in this case. In this case, the undisputed facts are that there was no cause. If you look at Mr. Stockwell's testimony in his deposition, in the supplemented pages 17 through 20, he very clearly says that it was an accident and the operation of the vehicle in no way caused the syringe to drop from his hand. And that's why summary judgment was, in fact, appropriate here. There are no disputed facts. And under those circumstances, judgment as a matter of law is appropriate here.
Counsel, these events occurred after a change in the law regarding sovereign immunity, because for a period of time, didn't insurance companies take the position that if it's a, this is a municipal EMS truck,
correct,
isn't it?
Correct, it is.
That since they have immunity on insured motorist coverage, in other words, if they rolled this thing over, wasn't that the position insurance companies took for a while?
Well, there was a change in 3937.18 that incorporated the sovereign immunity statute. What's significant here, though, is that sovereign immunity statute that would apply involves the driving of the ambulance. There is no question here that the driving of the vehicle was done in a non-negligent manner. No one is suggesting that the paramedic who was operating this ambulance in any way operated the ambulance in a negligent manner. There is a totally different statute that provides immunity in this case for the paramedic that was administering the medical care and treatment. And that is not included within the current or the version of the UM statute that was in effect on the date of this incident. So that even strengthens the argument as to why it needs to be the negligent operation of the vehicle that leads to the injury and not just something that happens accidentally within the confines of that vehicle. So I would submit to you, Your Honor, that the inclusion of that sovereign immunity statute language in the UM statute in fact emphasizes that it must be the operation of the vehicle that is at issue, not something that happens within the confines of the vehicle.
Well, is it your position then that this vehicle is insured or uninsured, the ambulance?
The difficulty with that question is that it would be uninsured if it had been not operated negligently, but it wasn't operated negligently. So that question really is not relevant here. It could be an additional argument as to why Motorist Mutual was entitled to judgment in its favor as a matter of law. But the fact of the matter is the sovereign immunity statute that would apply for the operation of the vehicle doesn't apply here. It's the provision that affords both the paramedic and the municipality immunity due to the conduct of the paramedic administering aid, and that's revised code 4765.49, not referenced anywhere within the UM statute at all. The flawed reasoning of the 8th District Court of Appeals is evident when you look at what Judge Cooney mentioned in her dissenting opinion. This is no different than if there was a police officer who was escorting a suspect and he accidentally discharged his weapon in the vehicle. Police vehicles are equipped with weapons, and the 8th District's analogy or reference to the fact that needles and syringes are part and parcel of an ambulance does not make this or bring this within the parameter of the language either in the statute or in the UM policy at issue in this case. I'm running out of time because I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal. So unless there are additional questions from the court, I would ask that the 8th District Court of Appeals decision be reversed and that the summary judgment decision of the trial court be reinstated. Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. DeBadges.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Henry DeBadges. I represent the estate of Paul Nord. This case should not have been thrown out on summary judgment. The Court of Appeals found issue that reasonable minds could not draw but one conclusion. In fact, they reversed the trial court and made a decision that there is an issue for the trier of fact to determine.
And what is that issue?
Whether they're under the law, under Kish, under the trilogy that was cited by the appellants, motorists, whether there was an intervening event unrelated to the use of the ambulance to take it out of the policy language, Your Honor, that the
and
injury.
What evidence did you offer when you were hit with the motion for summary that there was not an intervening occurrence?
There was no dispute that it was an accident, that this paramedic dropped the syringe. He testified at deposition that The ambulance was traveling about 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, as it normally does on an emergency run, that it was moving at the time at this rate of speed, that he dropped the syringe, it bounced off the oxygen mask. While the ambulance is still moving, it landed in Mr. Nord's eye. And the Court of Appeals determined that the use of the paramedic, the use of the syringe in connection with the ambulance, that there was some issue whether this arose out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of the ambulance, and that the syringe could be considered a piece of equipment that's part and parcel along with the EMS technician as part of the ambulance. And
I had some difficulty with that conclusion. The syringe really can be used any place, can it not? It's not really, was it attached to the
No.
some kind of a device to the vehicle itself? A syringe is a syringe, is it not?
It certainly is, Your Honor. But it's something that's part of the equipment of an ambulance. An ambulance has been defined as a vehicle to transport the sick, a mobile field hospital, and the equipment that's within the ambulance is part of the ambulance. So this trilogy of cases, there's not an intervening event, for example, a shooting that occurs after a traffic accident and an argument, or a rape that occurs at a house away from the vehicle that was considered to be uninsured. This happened in the ambulance while the ambulance was transporting Mr. Nord, and resulted from an accident. That's the policy language.
Well, Counselor, are you saying that it had to be a negligent operation of the vehicle that would cause the paramedic to have dropped the needle, the syringe, and thereby injuring? And
no.
That is the issue that has to go to the jury?
I'm saying the issue has to deal with, it deals with the policy language, and the policy language doesn't say negligent operation of the vehicle. The policy language says an accident resulting from the ownership, maintenance, or use of the vehicle.
All right, so let me rephrase that then. Just the driving of the vehicle would be sufficient in your scenario, your rationale there, or does there have to be a link to the movement of the vehicle causing the paramedic to drop the syringe?
I don't believe there has to be a link, as long as there's no intervening event that removes it from the ownership, maintenance, or use.
So it doesn't matter to you whether there was any cause within the movement of the vehicle to impact on the actions of the paramedic.
No.
Just by the fact that they were housed in this vehicle.
Yes.
All right, let me ask you, if the vehicle was stationary, would you be making the same argument?
Yes.
Okay, so movement,
yes.
All right, so getting back to some of the earlier questions about, and you mentioned that the vehicle was traveling 10 miles over the speed limit, that's irrelevant to your argument.
Essentially.
So you're saying merely because they happen to be, rather than outside the vehicle on a gurney, they were inside the vehicle, give rise to the coverage that is allowed for in the policy.
I should correct that. It's not irrelevant, and it bolsters our argument that it arises out of the maintenance, ownership, or use of the ambulance as an ambulance. The fact that
there's many uses for an ambulance, and one is the treatment that is going
Certainly.
On, whether it's moving or stationary.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it has no relevance whether this vehicle is moving, because you have no link between the operation of the vehicle and the dropping of the syringe. You're just saying because this vehicle was covered by this policy under this language, and the patient and the EMT were inside the vehicle, that's sufficient
right.
to give rise to coverage.
Well, given these facts, though, I think the movement of the vehicle, a jury might infer that instead of dropping to the floor, the syringe, because the vehicle was moving, ended up in Mr. Nord's eye because of the movement. I don't know. But
you don't have any evidence to that?
No, I don't. But the
Well, then how can a jury even, you know, all right, never mind.
The Court of Appeals found that the crux of the case was, as a matter of law, whether the accidental dropping of the syringe arose out of this ownership, maintenance, or use of the vehicle. And there's an issue. They found that it was something that occurred out of that policy language. It was a valid uninsured motorist claim, and this was a valid claim. We believe that the law and Mr. Nord's insurance policy say there's coverage for this accident and that the trial court should not have granted summary judgment. The Court of Appeals recognized that, and this court should affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, and with whatever time I have remaining, Mr. Chief Justice, I would ask that Mr. Levy be allowed to address the court.
Thank you, Mr. DeBadges.
Thank you.
Mr. Levy has a little over 8 minutes.
I just wanted to mention a couple things in rebuttal to appellant's position. One is in regard to the Kish case. And the Kish case, he indicated that the intent of the wrongdoer is irrelevant. And we disagree with that because in all these cases, the intent of the wrongdoer in the Kish case and the other two cases cited in the Supreme Court, coverage was denied because these were intentional acts. And the court said we're not going to allow it for criminal actions. In fact, the court's even gone further and done that in under homeowners policies, where if the action of the wrongdoer is intentional, you know, either hitting or shooting somebody, they say there's no coverage. So it definitely is the intent of the wrongdoer involved here. And in this case, again, we get back to the accidental. We also get back to the contract. In addition, we did cite the Darst case, which was also, which is a Court of Appeals case, but it was cited by our Court of Appeals in this matter, which was a case where there was no movement of the vehicle. And the court found that there was coverage because it was ownership and control. This is where these two kids were burned when they got matches in the car. And they said that that was a negligent act and it was covered under the insurance policy. And the car was parked. The kids were in the car was parked. And the court found coverage under the policy language.
So you agree that it's the mere situs of the injury that controls here? In other words, anything that happens in a car would be use of the car.
If there's negligence, and there was negligence here, and we're going right back to the contract language. And the contract language says, you know, ownership and control, and that's what it is here.
Well, then your co-counsel just answered that, you know, the movement of the vehicle has some sort of relevance here for a jury to make some kind of finding that just based on the logistics and the speed and whatever else, but for that, the syringe would have landed on the floor rather than in Mr. Nord's eye. Now, what do you say to that?
Well, we always like to argue in the alternative
in case
you get it past that one point. The other thing that I would like to mention is counsel for the insurance company is trying to distinguish between the person driving the vehicle and the person that's administering to Mr. Nord. They're both EMTs, and they act as a team. So they have joint control of this vehicle, and to distinguish one from the other, it could have just been the reverse situation also, it goes back to the same thing. It goes back to ownership and control of the vehicle. And we believe that the 8th District Court of Appeals should be approved.
Well, counsel, I didn't get that he was distinguishing between the two individuals. Certainly, if the driver had suddenly swerved, causing the EMT holding the syringe to drop it, that would be an issue related to the operation of the vehicle in terms of the causation of the incident.
I think he was trying to distinguish based on the immunity statute. And we...
I drug him into that because it was my understanding for a period of time insurance companies were taking the approach that if immunity applies to a municipality, then your uninsured motorist coverage is out the window. And I think the legislature changed that, didn't they, so that even if there is immunity for the driving, the uninsured motorist coverage still kicks in if there was negligence involved in the driving.
Well, correct, except we're going beyond that. We're saying that the negligence doesn't have to be with the driver. The negligence can be with the other EMT person.
But that's medical negligence, is his
point. No, we're just saying it's the negligent operation one way or the other. It's the fact that it happens in the vehicle, it's the policy language which controls.
But I think the distinction he was making is, as he was saying, if the causation is medical negligence, that wasn't in the change enacted by the legislature with respect to whether or not insurance companies could walk away from their uninsured motorist coverage based on sovereign immunity.
I guess he was, but we disagree with that.
Okay.
I thank you all.
Yeah, I think your point is your case is all about the vehicle.
Correct. And, you know, based on the policy language, we believe there's coverage. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Mr. Fitzgerald, you saved a little more than 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's clear from what's just been told to the court that what the appellees really are asking this court to do is to recognize a but-for test, that but for the fact that the accident happened in an ambulance, there should be uninsured motorist coverage here, and that was expressly rejected by this court in Kish. The distinction as to whether or not negligence versus intentional conduct has also been addressed by this court on two separate occasions, both in the Howell case. This is what the court said. Kish concluded that recovery could be had under the uninsured motorist policy irrespective of the mental state of the tortfeasor, intentional or negligent. Then in 1995, Justice Pfeiffer, you writing in the Latanzi case, recognized that the Kish and Howell reiterate that whether the act of the tortfeasor is negligent or intentional is not determinative of recovery, but that the key factor is the instrumentality used by the tortfeasor to cause the injury. Here that instrumentality was the syringe and the needle that was accidentally dropped, had nothing to do with the motor vehicle. In terms of the recognition of that was made by the Second District in the Grange versus Darst case, there the court expressly found that the vehicle itself was an instrumentality that caused the injury. The fire caused the flames and the smoke that killed and injured the two children that were occupants of that vehicle. Darst really should be limited to its facts. It doesn't apply here. And we would respectfully request that the 8th District Court of Appeals decision be reversed. Summary judgment was appropriate, and we would ask that the court reinstate that decision.
Counsel, I have one question. All the cases that you've referred to, did they have identical language that we're looking at in the contract here? If you parse the contracts in those cases, would it have had the same clause regarding the liability for the damages arising out of ownership, maintenance, or use of the uninsured motor
yes.
vehicle?
Kish, Howell, and Latanzi all had that arising out of language, as did the court in, I would call the court's attention to the Newman versus St. Paul case, which is cited in our brief. It's an Alabama Supreme Court case that involved an ambulance in which the paramedic providing treatment in the back of the ambulance failed to administer oxygen to the woman they were transporting, and she ended up dying. There the court's I see that I'm out of time. May I just conclude briefly, Your Honor?
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
Thank you, Your Honor.